I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. The staff of the Daily News in New York is smaller by half after cuts by its parent company, Tronc. Jason Schwartz of Politico on what the cuts mean for coverage of local news and what it might portend for the future of the Baltimore Sun. The president feuds with his former lawyer as he tries to defuse a fight with Europe. The Freedom Caucus fight with Rod Rosenstein is heating up. GDP is up a whopping 4.1% last quarter. Facebook is way down. Hundreds of immigrant families have yet to be reunited. North Korea says it has sent some soldiers' remains back home. And the White House tells a pool reporter, "I beg your pardon, I never promised you a rose garden." Darlene Superville of the AP joins me, plus a preview of Dark Money, a new film about corruption in politics. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall, and we are glad that you've joined us today for Midday. A little later in the program, I'll talk to Darlene Superville. She's a White House correspondent for the Associated Press. We'll talk about some of the big headlines in a week that has seen yet another tsunami of headlines from the White House and various investigations about the Trump administration that are ongoing. I'll also talk to the producer of a new film called Dark Money, which opens at the Parkway Theater tonight. It's a deep dive into the influence of money in politics and how that influence has become as insidious as it is. But first, we begin the Midday News Wrap with Jason Schwartz. He covers media for Politico. The Tronc Company owns several newspapers around the country, including the Daily News in New York and the Baltimore Sun. This week, Tronc made dramatic cuts in the newsroom at the Daily News, and we thought we should have a conversation about what that means, not only in New York, but what it could mean here in Baltimore and around the country. Jason Schwartz joins us from the headquarters of Politico in Arlington, Virginia. Jason, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, first of all, the extent of the damage to the newsroom at the Daily News. Tell us how many people were laid off.
I believe it was 93, about half the newsroom. A pretty unprecedented, wipeout. We've, of course, in media gotten used to layoffs at newspapers and other publications, but for half of the people to disappear in one fell swoop without apparently any sort of plan of what to do the next day was pretty striking.
So really, and that's been reported widely, that they didn't seem to have a particular notion of how they were going to continue. I mean, now that this has been going on for 4 or 5 days, what does it look like is going to happen at the Daily News? Are they simply going to stop covering certain things? Or are they going to take a lot of wire copy? How's this going to work?
I don't think they know. One of the most startling things about this was the lack of planning involved. The night of the layoffs, the people were tweeting pictures from the press box at the Yankees and Mets games of, empty seats where the Daily News reporters were, because they literally didn't have people covering the Yankees and Mets, which has for years been the bread and butter of this sort of paper, how they pay the bills. So they really, went into this, headlong without any true plan of how they were going to figure it out. I think a safe assumption is there will be less reporting and more aggregation, though, which is not good news for anyone.
And did they give particular reasons for this paper this time and that dramatic a cutback? I mean, they own several other papers. I mean, this is a company-wide decision, but they seem to concentrate their focus on the Daily News.
There was all the standard boilerplate about how the internet makes reporting easier and faster these days, and there will be efficiencies, and we're going to be a lean newsroom going forward with a focus on breaking news. But as for why New York Daily News, it's not entirely clear right now. I haven't seen a good explanation of that.
And what do you think, in a general way, this is going to mean for coverage of local stories in New York? And should one extrapolate what's going on in New York with what it could mean and could portend for cities like ours here in Baltimore, which is has a paper, the Baltimore Sun, that's owned by the same company?
Yeah, it's not good news for anyone, unfortunately. My colleague Michael Calderon wrote about it this week at Politico, talking about how coverage in New York, local coverage, has been on the downswing for a few years now. You saw the Wall Street Journal pulling back on its local coverage. The New York Times has pulled back on its local coverage. Village Voice is, a shadow of what it used to be. DNA Info, a local site that used to exist, is gone. And, you know, Michael talked to a former Daily News editor in his piece, and the quote that really struck me was the former editor said, if this is happening in New York, imagine what's going on in the rest of the country. So, yeah, I think if I were in Baltimore and working for the Sun, owned by Tronc, I would not feel great.
And is there it seems to be an interesting dichotomy in what's happening with the so-called national newspapers. And you mentioned the New York Times, which obviously has the capacity or had at one time the capacity to cover local stories and maybe is making executive decisions not to do so. But when you think about the so-called national papers, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, we understand that perhaps in response to the Trump administration, the subscription rate and the actual people reading those publications is way up since the election of Donald Trump. But yet local papers continue to suffer and to really have a difficult time. How do you explain that? Is that dichotomy true, first of all? And if so, how do you explain it?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the dangerous things is that there's this perception, I think, that media is booming. You know, the Trump bump, the Times numbers are up, the Washington Post numbers are up. At the same time, news deserts are a bigger problem in the country than they've ever been. And we do have these local newspapers that aren't buoyed by this huge interest in national politics that are suffering. And they also can't rely on the same subscriber bases that a national paper like the Times or the Post could. So yeah, it's absolutely a big problem going on right now.
It's a whole different pool of advertisers. I mean, if you're the New York Times, you don't necessarily have to sell to consumers or to businesses in New York. You can sell to businesses that have a reach nationwide or even internationally because the readers are not all going to come from New York.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, the other phenomenon we're seeing is these you know, private equity firms buying up a lot of local papers and really sort of strip mining them for profits and leaving the carcasses by the side of the road, if you will. Alden Global Capital owns a number of newspapers. They just bought my personal hometown, Boston Herald. And, you know, they're really gutting these papers for profits.
On the other hand, Tronc did sell the Los Angeles Times, one of their big, star properties, to a physician, a very wealthy physician, Sun Sheng, in Los Angeles. They got $500 million for that. That seems like an awful lot of money, yet not long after that sale, they decided to make these cuts at the Daily News.
Yeah, you know, and the other thing a lot of people would notice is former executive Michael Farrow, who left under not the best circumstances with some scandal, getting a $15 million payout on his way out the door. Their priority is not investing in journalism. I think that's pretty clear. Their priority is their profits and you know, getting money to their investors.
You wrote about an interesting situation at the Pentagon. Of course, in the last couple of days, we've heard a lot about Caitlin Collins of CNN. She was the TV pool reporter at the White House and was disallowed to attend an open press event in the Rose Garden. But you've written about how media access at the Pentagon is also decreasing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, it's been since April that Secretary Mattis gave a on-camera briefing at the Pentagon. Since May, since his top spokesperson did, and a lot of reporters were telling me that officials who used to be able to speak to them no longer were. Mattis used to, you know, walk through the press room with some regularity and talk with reporters, and it had been weeks since he had done that. And actually, after our story published yesterday, today he actually did go meet with reporters and give some on-the-record statements, so that was good. But, yeah, I think there's a general feeling among Pentagon reporters that they're just not getting the same level of information that they used to about what the American military is doing.
And the juxtaposition of that with the narrative that people like Secretary Mattis are the sort of grown-ups in the room around the president, whose actions and behavior are often characterized as, you know, inconsistent and volatile and sometimes even incomprehensible. People are looking to the sort of steady hands of people like General Mattis, who supposedly, you know, calmed the fears of European leaders after the NATO summit, who, you know, told everybody to calm down after the press conference in Helsinki with the president and Vladimir Putin. So you've got people saying, well, don't worry, Mattis is, you know, telling people what's really happening. And people like Mattis. General Kelly, the chief of staff, is another one in that category. But now you have Mattis, who's not actually talking to the press hardly at all. That's interesting.
You know, one of the things I heard from people is that he's trying to sort of walk this line where he's trying to stay out of the media, frankly, out of the off of cable news, out of the eye of the cable news watcher in chief, if you will. And he sort of views that as the way to keep the military out of politics and protect the military. The problem of that is the upshot is that the American people are getting less information about, you know, the wars that we're in, what our military is doing. So, you know, there's got to be some balance there. And I think a lot of people think he's tilted too far away from disclosure and transparency.
I am not often struck by tweets, but I was struck by one a couple of days ago from Sherilyn Ifill from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And she tweeted, no White House logs, no readouts of calls with foreign leaders, 2 hours with Putin with no one else present, no press conferences, 2 days a week at his private club, no tax returns, close family members as senior advisors. Trump has successfully privatized the presidency.
Yeah, and, you know, White House press briefings as well, you know, feel like less frequent than ever, almost a thing of the past at this point. I think maybe one this week, but, you know, we're just getting less and less information. And, of course, I'd add to that list the statement to not believe what you see or hear, right?
Yeah, which was just yesterday, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's all sort of a piece.
And how does this compare, for example, to press access in the Obama administration or the George W. Bush administration or Clinton or any of the previous administrations?
Oh, I think it's safe to say that what we're seeing now is pretty unprecedented. That, you know, the readouts of the phone calls, for instance, is not a thing that we've ever taken away before. You know, previous administrations saw that as advantageous, as a way to shape perception of these interactions with foreign leaders. But with this administration, everything is combat, it seems, with the press.
You also wrote about the Sinclair deal. Sinclair is a company a lot of folks in our neighborhood know about because they're based right here in Hunt Valley, Maryland. It looked like that thing was happening. It was taking a long time. They were going to buy the Tribune Company, and they had agreed to sell certain stations to avoid conflicts of interest in particular markets. And then all of a sudden, the head of the FCC came out with some somewhat damning comments about it, and it seems like that deal is dead. What can you tell us about the latest on that?
Yeah, you know, that was a little bit like, to use a football analogy, that was a little bit like Leon Lett running for the end zone and celebrating and getting the ball stripped out just on the one-yard line. Sinclair, I think, thought they had this thing all wrapped up when the FCC made its ruling. So the big question now is August 8th, both Sinclair and Tribune Media can leave the deal if they want. So I think a lot of people believe that Sinclair will fight it out, try to, you know, go through this arduous process, months-long, maybe years-long process with the FCC to try to save the deal. The question will be is if Tribune Media, which is a publicly traded company with a stock, cuts its losses and, you know, looks for other buyers for what it's trying to sell.
And interesting, the people who opposed this deal included, and you were writing about this, Newsmax, Chris Ruddy, who's a, you know, confidant of the president, Rupert Murdoch, Fox News. This would have been bad for, or this, if it goes through, this will be bad for business for Newsmax and Fox, right?
Yeah, you know, Rupert Murdoch gets his way again, right? So it's been a pretty good summer for Rupert between the Sinclair deal falling through just today. It looks like the Fox and Disney merger, or, I'm sorry, the sale of assets of Fox to Disney is going to go through to completion. He's received some favorable rulings, and it's, you know, it's sort of a pattern at this point.
What do you make of the president's tweet that the FCC comments about Sinclair were unfair, and it's too bad the deal isn't going through? Is that to be believed, or is that subterfuge?
You know, it's hard to know at any one time what he's thinking. You know, I spoke the other day to former Fox News host Eric Bolling. who has taught. So the Sunday night before the president sent that tweet, Bowling had a conversation with him. Bowling was sort of lined up, it looks like, to be in play for a job with the cable news lineup that Sinclair was playing to watch. And basically, Bowling was on the phone with the president complaining about the deal not going through, letting him know his view. And it looks like that's what made it to Twitter. So that's sort of how these things seem to work these days, the last person in the ear. So what the president truly believes, you know, certainly Sinclair has been very, very kind to him with its coverage. But it's hard to know what, if any, influence he exerted on the FCC in this process.
Jason Schwartz reports on the media for Politico. Jason, thanks so much. I appreciate it. And talk again soon, I hope.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Before we take a break, I want to let you know about a networking event that's taking place tonight at 7 o'clock at the Arena Players in Baltimore. It's apropos of nothing, actually, but it is going to be an interesting event at the Arena Players. Robert Guignard is a cancer survivor and a speaker who founded an organization called DBDB, which stands for Dream It, Believe It, Do It, Be It. And he's assembled a group of speakers, including the artist Larry Brown, the women's advocate Tiffany Gill, the musician Wayne Bruce, and wellness expert Lorena Lewis, for an evening of conversation about different approaches to life and wellness at the Arena Players. We've got a link to the event on our website, wypr.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, Darlene Superville of the Associated Press joins me as the Midday News Wrap continues. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, another in our continuing series of conversations with the candidates. I'll be joined in Studio A by two Republican candidates, both of whom are vying to unseat longtime Democratic incumbents in the November election. Richmond Davis will join me here at the top of the hour. He's running against Representative Elijah Cummings in the 7th Congressional District. And Liz Matory, a former Democrat and the author of the book Born Again Republican, is running against incumbent Democrat Dutch Ruppersberger in the 2nd District. So she'll join me as well midday Monday. Now we continue the Midday News Wrap with a look behind some of the other big headlines of the week. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is AP White House reporter Darlene Superville. Darlene, it's been a long time. Welcome back. Good to hear from you.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Sure. There are so many stories to talk about. You know, so many things. What is it?
Where do you begin?
Exactly. I mean, what's that T-shirt? You know, so much beer, so little time. But it's the president says he knows nothing about. Let's start with the president and what he says he doesn't know. And he said he knew nothing about a famous meeting, now infamous meeting, that took place in June of 2016 between Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner and some people from Russia. And now we understand from his lawyer that, in fact, not only was he told about the meeting afterwards, he knew about it beforehand. What can you tell us about that one?
That's right. People close to Michael Cohen, who is the president's longtime personal lawyer, who he has now had a falling out with the president, say that he's prepared to go to federal authorities, to special counsel Robert Mueller, and tell the special counsel that President Trump knew about this meeting before it happened. And the meeting, as you mentioned, involved Donald Trump Jr. Jared Kushner was president. He's not president, present. He's the president's son-in-law, and he's now a unpaid senior advisor at the White House. And Paul Manafort, who was then the chairman of the Trump campaign, also attended this meeting. And it was a meeting that supposedly the Russian officials who were there were supposed to turn over dirt on Hillary Clinton, and that was something that Don Jr. was eager to receive. But Don Jr. later said the meeting was a waste of time. It had lasted about 20 minutes, and they talked about Russian adoptions or something, and the people didn't have the dirt that they promised to have. It would be significant if, in fact, it is proven that the president knew about the meeting beforehand, because that could demonstrate some element of the collusion factor, which is what the special counsel is investigating with regard to the 2016 president.
Look, this is a confusing election. Week for everybody. Don't worry.
And Russia's attempts to interfere with the election to try to help Donald Trump. So it would be significant if it's proven that he knew about the meeting beforehand. He says he didn't. Michael Cohen says he does. He did. We'll have to wait and see, what the truth ultimately is.
Yeah, and following this meeting, the president putatively was on Air Force One drafting a statement explaining what the agenda of the meeting was after it happened. That's now been proven to not have been true. The president evidently was involved with Hope Hicks and others drafting a statement for Donald Trump Jr. to issue that says they were talking about Russian adoptions, but we now know pretty definitively that, in fact, they were talking about a lot of other stuff.
Other stuff, yeah. And the statement was drafted. That came a year later after the New York Times was the news organization that broke the story of this meeting last year, 2017, of the meeting happening in 2016. And so when the Times went to the White House for comment, to tell them, hey, we're about to publish this story on this meeting that took place at Trump Tower, it happened to be during a time when the president was overseas. He was flying back to the United States. And it was on Air Force One at that time that he helped draft the statement that later turned out not to be accurate.
Yeah, a whole year later. And, is it plausible that in June of 2016, at that point, Mr. Trump had been a candidate for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he had been very politically active. He'd had aspirations for the White House going back 30 years. But he had been in the actual game for about a year. Is it plausible that he and Manafort and Trump Jr. and Kushner simply were unaware of the fact that it's not legal to coordinate campaign activities with representatives of a foreign government or even people who appear to be foreign nationals if you don't know everything about them? I mean, is it plausible that there's just simply it didn't occur to them that this was a bad idea? They heard the term dirt on Hillary Clinton and they leapt
on
it
like crazy.
And they just got excited. Yeah.
I suppose that is a plausible explanation, and it may even be one that they'll try to throw out there at some point. But another thing to remember is that Paul Manafort was at that meeting, and Paul Manafort has been around in Republican political circles for longer than Donald Trump, and that was one of the reasons that Donald Trump brought Paul Manafort onto his campaign, because he had all this experience with elections and campaigns and counting delegates and those kinds of matters. So you would have to think that even if Donald Trump or Don Jr. didn't know, that Paul, some sort of antenna should have maybe gone up from Paul Manafort.
And the other thing that involved Mr. Cohen this week was a tape that he made, evidently surreptitiously, of a discussion that he had with Donald Trump. It was released to CNN by Lanny Davis, Mr. Cohen's current lawyer. And they're talking about payments to a Playboy model named Karen McDougal, which involved killing a story that was supposed to run in the National Enquirer. It's been a few days since people have parsed this thing, word for word, syllable for syllable. What's the current thinking about what that tape shows and what kind of problems that tape might present for the president and what kind of problems that tape might solve for Michael Cohen?
Yeah, the tape itself is a little hard to hear. You hear Michael Cohen talking about sort of running through a checklist of things, almost as if he's updating the president on things that he's done on, well, he wasn't president at the time, but things that he's done on Donald Trump's behalf. And then they get into talking about, you hear him mention the word or the name, who many people believe is the name of the organization that bought the rights to Karen McDougal's story but then never published it. And so that's what they're talking about, paying for the rights to this story. And you hear the president say the word cash at one point on the tape. His lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, says that he was saying don't pay with cash. The Michael Cohen side says he was sort of saying pay with cash. It's all a little bit muddled.
People tend to put a lot of faith in, you know, the sort of definite nature of tape recordings. They're not always definite in nature.
No, and when I heard it the first time, it sounded to me like the president was maybe asking a question, you know, like, do we pay with cash? You know, it sounded like a question more than a statement kind of thing. So there recordings are open to all sorts of interpretation. You don't have the beginning of the conversation. You don't have the end of the conversation because the tape cuts off a little bit abruptly. So there is a lot of there's a lot that's missing there.
Yeah.
But you know, the White House has always said, and the president's campaign had always said, that he knew nothing about this. And the one thing that the tape seems to establish is that he does, because the recording was made in September of 2016, which was 2 months before the election, at a time when they said, we don't know anything about this.
And is there anything in the tape that would indicate that the payment to Ms. McDougal was, in fact, an illegal campaign contribution, given the proximity to the election? We're talking September, as you mentioned, just 2 months before the election.
There are those issues out there. My understanding is that there was no payment made, but I've also heard election lawyers and people who know more about election law than I do say that you don't even need to have a check be cut, just as long as you're kind of talking about this and doing something about this close to an election, you know, that could be enough to get you in trouble.
I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. My guest today, Darlene Superville, a White House reporter for the AP. And Darlene, when we see a video of the scrums in the Oval Office or before the president gets on his helicopter or various other locations, you are in the middle of that scrum on very many occasions. Mm-hmm. This week, CNN reporter Caitlin Collins was disallowed from attending the event in the Rose Garden after President Trump met with the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. She is a reporter for CNN, but she was there that afternoon in her capacity as the TV pool reporter. Explain what happened and what you think about it.
Well, as a TV pool reporter, not all of the networks can go in with all their cameras. So you can't have NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, and CNN all cramming into the Oval Office. So there's a pool situation where they rotate, and this day it was CNN's turn to go in to send in a reporter and a crew and to represent all of the other TV networks. So they share the video and the audio and all that kind of material. And when you go in there, you know, it's beneficial for both sides, right? The White House will get pictures and video of the president shaking hands with Juncker or whatever head of state or dignitary is visiting him. But more importantly for us, it's an opportunity to try to get the president to answer questions on whatever the news of the day is. And that day, the news of the day happened to be the Michael Cohen tape, and there were also some questions about Russian President Vladimir Putin. And so Caitlin was in the Oval Office, and the president made his remarks, and Jean-Claude Juncker made a few remarks, and then after that, before the White House assistants try to make everyone leave the Oval Office, you hear this big, you know, sort of outburst of reporters shouting their questions. Caitlin did what everyone does every single time we go into one of these what are called pool sprays, and she asked him about Michael Cohen, and she asked about Vladimir Putin. The White House, later that day, they did this availability in the Rose Garden with the president and Jean-Claude Juncker, where they announced some sort of way forward on the tariff situation and the trade situation between the U.S. and the EU. They told Caitlin that she would not be allowed to attend that because of her behavior in the Oval Office, which she didn't do anything out of the ordinary. She did what we all do every single day. They said that they were not allowing her to attend the subsequent event because she was asked to leave the Oval Office several times and she refused to leave. I wasn't in there personally. One of my colleagues from AP was in there that particular day, but I find it hard to believe that she would refuse to leave. What happens is a lot of people, we often don't want to leave because you want to wait and see if the president will answer any one of the 50 questions that are being shouted at him. And you don't want to be the reporter who is not in the room when the president is talking. So we all kind of wait around a little bit to see if he's going to answer a question. That day he didn't. He was pretty firm that he wasn't going to take any questions. But that's not a reason to bar somebody from an event that is not a pool event. It's an event that's open to all credentialed media. So if the White House either has cleared you in to be on the grounds that day or you have a White House pass, you can go.
And do we know how long this injunction against Caitlin Collins being, you know, in the proximity of the president is to last? Have you heard anything about that?
I think it was just for that one event. You know, CNN will be up. It will be their turn in the pool again 5 days from that. And we'll see if she's the reporter that has pool duty that day or if it's another one of her colleagues.
The Freedom Caucus wants to impeach Rod Rosenstein, whose office, by the way, told us a year ago that his last name is pronounced Rosenstein. But I'm gonna bow to pressure.
Oh, everyone says Rosenstein.
I know. Well, we called the office, and I talked to Mr. Rosen, whoever is assistant. How does he pronounce his last name? She said, without any doubt, Rosenstein.
Anyway,
everyone else is saying Rosenstein, and Mr. Rosenstein himself gave a press conference in which he said it could be either way. So we're going with Rosenstein, but that's neither here nor there. But there's a whole lot of people other than the 11 members of the Freedom Caucus who don't want to impeach Mr. Rosenstein. One of the people who does is a guy named Jim Jordan, who's a Republican from Ohio, and very coincidentally, I'm sure they're not linked in any way whatsoever, he's running for Speaker of the House. What can you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, impeaching the Deputy Attorney General, I'm going to take that out and call him the Deputy Attorney General, is not going to happen. You know, impeachment is reserved for high crimes and misdemeanors. It's not reserved for a sub-cabinet official who is in a dispute with a member of Congress or a group of members of Congress over documents. And Paul Ryan this week said basically that it's not going to happen. You shouldn't be cavalier with using the word impeachment or the impeachment process. And I think Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has also poured cold water on that idea. So it's not going to happen. As for Jim Jordan and his aspirations to be Speaker, that remains to be seen. You know, there are lots of people that are eyeing the speakership now that Paul Ryan has decided to step down and to leave Congress next year. And one hurdle that Jim Jordan is going to have to surmount is this recent issue that surfaced where you have these former members of the wrestling team where he was, I think it was in Ohio.
Ohio. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who, you know, say that he knew about abuse by another member of the wrestling team, and Jim Jordan says he didn't know anything about it, and had he known, he would have done something. It seems to have quieted down in the last couple of weeks, but once he throws his hat into the ring for Speaker, that's all going to be, you know, resurface again. And some of the Freedom Caucus members are not the most popular members on the Hill or in the Republican caucus, so he'll be facing that again too.
It's interesting too, this weird predilection for Republicans to want to have former wrestling coaches be elected Speaker of the House. I mean, Denny Hastert was, you know, who's now, I believe, serving a jail term for child sexual abuse, was a wrestling coach from Ohio who became Speaker of the House. What is the deal with that? Have you done a long expose with the AP about that? I certainly hope so. This is a story
question.
Begging to be written.
I'll toss it to my Ohio colleagues to suggest it for them.
The president does have some good news on the economy. The GDP is up 4.1%. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's double what it was the quarter before. This is just for one quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, of course, all the haters out there who say, well, it can't be sustained. And perhaps it has something to do with soybean purchases that were made in advance of tariffs. But how's the White House playing this particular bit of good news?
Oh, they are thrilled. The president came out this morning. They did this sort of hastily arranged appearance on the South Lawn of the White House this morning where the president came out. The vice president joined him, pretty much the entire White House economic team, the president's entire White House economic team, from Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, Larry Kudlow, Council of Economic Advisors Chairman Kevin Hassett. They were all out on the South Lawn, and the president took a victory lap, and that's not something I begrudge him for. When you have good news, you want to make sure people know about it, and given all the bad news that he's gotten lately, why not come out and tout these economic numbers? So he, he called it amazing, the 4.1 rate, amazing. Said it's not a one-time deal, that he thinks these numbers can be sustained going into the next quarter. So we'll have to wait and see if that really happens.
And that was a big part of the justification for the tax cut. It sort of assumes economic growth at about this level, which has never happened in a sustained way in the past, or at least not for a really long time. One of the things they can't brag about is reuniting families that were separated at the border during the brief term of zero tolerance for people coming across seeking asylum as refugees and for other reasons as well. Where does that stand? How many folks have been reunited? How many remain to be reunited? The deadline for this set by a judge was yesterday.
Right. The deadline was last night, and last night they said that approximately 1,400, somewhere between 1,400 and 1,500 of those children age 5 and older had been reunited or returned to their parents. But there's about 700 or so more that are still separated. And the administration has not said a lot yet about how they're going to go about dealing with this remaining group of 700 or so kids that are still separated.
The judge in San Diego, other than being mad, what recourse does he have? What are there punitive measures that could be imposed on the administration in this instance?
Well, there's supposed to be a hearing later today in San Francisco in front of the same judge where some more data is supposed to be released, and I suspect that we could probably find out more in terms of penalties or anything like that if the judge feels the administration hasn't acted quickly enough to reunite these families, judge their plan for dealing with the 700 or so that still remain. So we'd want to hear what comes out of the hearing this afternoon.
I want to finish up by asking you about the fact that the president has evidently backed away from having Vladimir Putin come to the White House in September.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that decision was made?
Well, I think there's just so much in the atmosphere in Washington involving Russia, and the whole invitation for Vladimir Putin to come to Washington in the fall seemed to have been kind of rushed out. You know, they just had the summit in Helsinki not even 2 weeks ago. The president got a lot of blowback for his performance there, for appearing to side with Putin and his denials of interfering in the election. Then he came back to the U.S., and the White House and the president spent a couple days trying to set the record straight on whether or not he really believed Russia was involved in interfering in the election. And then in the middle of all that, outcomes were that he's asked John Bolton to invite Putin to Washington in the fall. Putin didn't immediately accept the invitation, and I think that may have had something to do with the decision to delay it a little bit and just sort of step back and let some of the temperature go down a little bit here in D.C. And today, Putin was in South Africa speaking at a different, unrelated meeting, and he said that he is willing to come to Washington if the conditions are right, and that he would invite the president to come to visit Moscow. And the White House later said today that the President Trump, is open to going to Moscow if he gets a formal invitation from Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
So
All of which, for better or for worse, helps us not remember the fact that Sunday night the president was tweeting in all caps threatening war against Iran. So I suppose that's a good thing, right? You know, you got to always look on the bright side of life. That's
change
what I say.
Change the subject, yeah, yes.
Exactly. Darlene Superville, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Thank you. You too.
Darlene Superville is a White House correspondent for the Associated Press. She will be in the press pool traveling with the president for a wonderful weekend in New Jersey. Midday continues after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. We'll be right back.